top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 386 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, Creep 2. Now, we've made no bones about our antipathy towards found footage POV, and that's only because it is both the most potentially impactful form you can use in a horror film, but also the most ubiquitous due to the decreased costs associated with its production. So, as a result, you get... there was a time when there was a flood of these types of productions, and there was only a few that stood out that could, in the same breath, be named alongside the iconic likes of, let's say, Cannibal Holocaust, or, let's say, Wreck, to name a few. I mean, there's a few that really stand out, like the Poughkeepsie Tapes, and Head Cases, and America's Deadliest Home Video. You know, that was a sort of a proto POV, but by the time you got to the likes of Blair Witch, all this kind of shaky camera work was a little bit nauseating, and if you didn't have a director's craft, it left a very unpolished, unfinished type of feel in the finished product. It wasn't particularly good. Now, one of the better POV style movies was Creep, which Jeff and I podcasted, directed by Patrick Bryce, who did the sequel as well, but also has a more straight ahead slasher. I think it's called It's Coming from the Basement. It's got some sort of very 80s slasher heyday style video nasty title. I can't recall, but the first movie was really a standout in my eyes, and a lot of people really lauded this film, and with good reason. For a terrific standout performance by Duplass, who a lot of people know from Mindy Kaling's show and other types of things, but not in this capacity. But he brings such an amazing amount of gravitas to the role, and it just goes to show you that at its most impactful, POV can be really, really, really good. And I think the first one was just exemplary and phenomenal, and kept you guessing. And the second one, I guess, from what I've read, is inspired by the likes of the Craigslist killer and Duplass's, I guess, own dealings, maybe on that site. I've had a few myself where I've just unloaded concert tickets I've won on the radio and various other items. And there is kind of a strange disconnect when you do meet someone wholly randomly, and it's almost like, well, I mean, through dating apps and whatnot, at least you meet someone in a public place, so they're not liable to like murder you in a full bar or whatever. But I've had people come over to the courtyard, and invariably, like if it's a guy, they'll say, oh, this seems kind of shady. It's almost like a drug deal going down. And the Craigslist killer, if I'm not mistaken, was a either a pre-med or maybe an actual med student, I want to say. It was in Boston that it took place, and it was super seedy and super gross. And the idea of just the privacy breach that you get from, or potentially so, by just inviting a complete stranger somewhere to do something is a perfect or canvas on which to paint. And speaking of art, I was thinking of... there's a quote by Georges Braque, the cubist and fauvist, well, beastly. And early, I believe he did impressionist style, but he had a quote saying, oh, what was it? Art's Art disturbs and science reassures. And in this case, you have a protagonist known as Sarah, who's trying to be provocative and failing, and through a web series whose name escapes me right now, but it's underwhelmingly received on YouTube, and she's run these different things. And her entire thing, and it's quite a good idea, is to randomly meet various eccentric, creepy weirdos online and go meet with them and chat with them and get a better sense of what they're all about through the kind of personal ads and stuff that they post, Kijiji, Craigslist style thing. And that's getting very, very little traction. And as any self-respecting artist, Sarah is consumed with the fact that she's not meeting her artistic ambitions. And she comes across, I guess, the character of Aaron, the Mark Duplass character, and she's about to give up the ghost on the series and go move on to something else. But there's something about the posting that she finds intriguing, and think there's something about how someone should have an interest in Interview with a Vampire. And so they connect a few times, and he says his favorite song is Sarah. And there's some dealings that are a little bit different from the typical, I guess, basement-dwelling neckbeard weirdo that she typically encounters. So when she goes over to meet with this character at his home, it's a lot different from some of the other people she's encountered. I mean, he's obviously more well-to-do and quite successful, and is not the typical, I guess, shut-in bizarro character that she's typically dealing with. So she sees a lot of promise in this. And when they get down to discussions, she's filming, and he starts to talk about and discloses the fact that he's actually a serial killer. So that perks her ears, and she figures that she can make hay while the sun shines with her last effort, and maybe do something that's really, really out there and edgy and really satisfying. And she throws herself into the proceedings. Quite a weird conceit when you think about it, because you would think any normal person would just hightail it out of there if you're sitting alone, especially as a woman, just alone in a room with someone who's disclosed the fact that they've murdered, I think, 29 people or something to that effect. But I guess she's so willing to, I guess, literally suffer for her art, and she's so desperate and attention grabbed. Like, she really is. They set her out. Patrick Bryce does set her out as a clout chaser, which is good, because people will do a lot of shit to gain traction online. So it's something that the filmmakers smartly make believable concept, because otherwise you'd think, just okay, get the hell out of there. But there's a certain charm, of course, that Duplass brings to this character, and it was so well developed in the first movie. And I won't spoil that one, but I'm sure a lot of people have seen it. And hell, maybe why would you be listening to a discussion about the sequel if you haven't seen the first one? But we know how that one went down, and that was a more conventional format and more of an issue of a predator luring in their prey, whereas this one, the prey is a lot more complicit. And she wants to do right by the documentary style of form. And although we don't discuss documentaries or web series or anything on this podcast, it can be just as impactful. I mean, they always say that fiction is timeless or eternal truths, right? But I think at its best, nonfiction or documentary style can be really, really mind-blowing art in its own right. Off the top of my head, there's a Canadian production that came out a few years back. It was called A Better Man. And my God, this is a documentary I urge everyone to just track down and view. In it, I think her name is Atiyah Khan. I think she lives around me too. I must have bumped into her because she looks very, very familiar. The concept behind that one was a woman who was abused in an abusive relationship. I believe it would have been in university. It could have been just post. It's been a while since I've seen it, so apologies. But she managed to convince and cajole her abuser to join her in this film and talk about their relationship. So, and he It actually shows his face, but goes, I think, by a pseudonym, and they meet up for coffee and discuss the abuse that this guy, I think he's dubbed Steve in the movie, it could be, and discuss how he basically pulled her hair and pulled her off the bed and I think beat her unconscious at several points, and how this film served as a conduit to her healing process is very, very interesting. And to hear her abuser, and to his credit, I mean, the guy is obviously trying to make penance and seek penance for, I mean, being the despicable character that he was. And in some sense, you actually derive a little bit of sympathy for him, and just the balls it took for this filmmaker. I want to say her name is Atiya Khan. I hope so. Something like that, but people can look it up. I want to say this is a 2017 effort, but my God, like just how gut-wrenching this film was. And there's others of its type too, even if the subject matter isn't as intense. Like When We Were Kings, for example, is a documentary that follows the rumble in the jungle that took place between George Foreman and Muhammad Ali in Africa, and there was a associated concert that was almost like the Black Woodstock, which had I think B.B. King and James Brown and a bunch of other just unbelievable timeless legends. And that was just a totally different film altogether, but a way to just really show just how larger than life a personality like Muhammad Ali was, in a way that sort of tepid Will Smith movie didn't, I would think. But this getting back to Creep 2, I mean, you have a documentary filmmaker, a desperate clout chaser, who really is wanting to tell a story that a lot of people, that will resonate with a lot of people. And you know, and it should also be said too that this is a scoop, right? So no one knows that this guy is a serial killer. Otherwise, it would just be one of those instances of going into your standard state penitentiary and sitting down with some, I don't know, Edmund Kemper or some creep like that, and getting their thoughts on the murders they committed. But this would have been a total scoop, as we say in journalism. And the interactions between Sarah and Aaron are just so good. And at one point, I guess Aaron tries to scare her and jump at her, but I mean, she's inured to that, and she is not fazed by any of his attempts to scare the living daylights out of her. And this works on the viewer, at least the first time, and then later not so much, but it's a great idea. And given that, I guess the metaphor of laying bare your soul is writ large, brought to life really with nudity too, because there's a particularly impactful scene where he strips down and then implores that Sarah do the same in some sort of vulnerability kinship. And you see Sarah take off her shorts and then her top and her bra and like stand and you know, naked before him. And it was something that I don't know if that's something I would have necessarily been totally on board with, but it just goes to show, like, it speaks to Sarah's character in a way. And people will go to amazing lengths to succeed on social. I mean, you see cases of people getting the ultimate Insta photo, right, by going to some precipice and then falling over the edge, or some sort of TikTok reel that is hyper dangerous and results in self-harm. So the idea that someone would be doing this would not have been believable 30 years ago, but is eminently believable, I think, now. And I really like the way the two of them developed a rapport. And you have this kind of a weird scene where Aaron is in a hot tub and he's listening to this jam band, this horrific music over and over and over again. And Sarah actually gets in the hot tub with him, and they attempt to have some sort of relations, or at least she with him. And then later it's disclosed that probably his sexuality is a bit ambiguous. If not, he's a little bit gay. a little bit gay. I'm not sure. Is that right even? But yeah, she gives him his first kiss, and the two of them discuss the parameters of their working together and what that's going to entail. And what an interesting idea for a horror film, because something so quiet and so self-contained, and something this really restrictive in its scope. Like when you think of something like a Dawn of the Dead, or or something in which you know, whole cities are involved in the horror. This is something completely different. It goes to show that in the right hands, even an effort with just two people can be particularly impactful. And my dinner with Andre was actually one of the films that inspired this one. So that I believe Louis Malle was the director of that one, and obviously, infamously, it involved, as its title would suggest, just back and forth, just a little bit of banter. And as much as I feel like I've railed against films that didn't have a narrative, like Saint Maud and that, I think, in fact, if you don't have a narrative and you don't have any sort of structure to your film, that a lot of compelling dialogue is enough to carry the load. And I've talked about the Before Sunrise trilogy with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, which just follows people around who meet on vacation and have this romance and just chatter and just walking and talking, that you really don't need the infamous, the Chekhov gun, and it has to be shown in one scene and then used in another, the dramatic a cliche of what's supposed to happen when. And Creep 2 deftly, although not as deftly as the first one, manages to just have a nice, quiet, introspective, and yet ultimately very, very creepy, as its name would suggest, result. And I thought it was pretty damn good. And, you know, it's funny, like, Blumhouse puts out a lot of dreck, and then the stuff that isn't dreck would be like this and Sinister and a handful of others, but the ratio of just crapola to good is just so high. They even did some Blumhouse Fantasy Island, and Jason Blum just, a lot of his stuff, he's like the anti-Midas, it turns to crap. And I don't like a lot of what they do, but he must have some sort of handle on the horror space, because the odd thing that he does put out is halfway decent. And this took a lot of, I mean, this is a lot of financial risk it would have undertaken to back something like this, because the market for it seems potentially rather small. It's hard to kind of, I mean, the title's just absolutely just rock solid and just above board, but something like a slasher is so much easier for people to digest, and you can just or something involving the supernatural, that's the most ubiquitous category really that you see on Netflix, it's a lot more intuitive. But a film like this is, I think, probably going to rub a lot of people the wrong way if they can't get behind the fact that it's just two people talking. But I thought the first one was just so dynamite, and the wolf head makes its reappearance in this one, although to no effect, because Sarah is, again, just like she is with his attempted jump scares, unfazed by this by his animal accoutrements. And there are a few callbacks to the first film too. I remember there was a scene where Aaron disappears in the woods, I believe there's somewhere in California, and there's this scene of a rock, and I remember that from the first film, where he disappears and then you think, uh-oh, this person is in the middle of nowhere with this self-professed serial killer, and she will meet her maker soon. But the two of them have developed an understanding and mutual trust that he is much more interested in getting his story out than he is with killing Sarah. And they discuss this at times as well, like, and she, I think, presses the issue, like, why don't you just throttle me now or whatever. In a way, this almost reminded me of the Edmund Kemper case, because that killer, the serial killer, I believe he was like 6'8", 6'9", just a giant of a man. And when the one of the FBI profilers, I believe, who was meeting with him, I believe Kemper was uncuffed, and at some point, I think, admitted later that he could have easily strangled this guy too. And but except for the fact that they had this understanding that he wanted to get his story told and wanted to discuss, I guess, his mommy issues, and the fact his mother was, I think, a prostitute as well or something. But yeah, it just, that dynamic is really chilling, because frequently in the horror space you get victims who have very little in the way of backstory for something like Don't Go Out in the Woods, or Friday the 13th, where, you know, all you're likely to get is maybe someone doffing their bikini and running around or singing a campfire song, and really very little in the way of personality. But you know, you get this this person, Sarah, who's just racked with self-doubt and probably going to shelve her artistic ambitions, and that's something that can send people into despair. And she's a really fantastic character. The ending, I guess we're going to segue a little bit into what we learned here, but there's a nicely ambiguous ending, and you sort of know that things are going to come to a head, which is by no means a debit to this film. I think it really succeeds on a number of levels, and my God, the first one, they really know how to press my buttons anyway, where you have really, really good performances and a runtime of 77 minutes, so you don't have stretches of things that are unnecessary and just extra frills. You just get to the bare bones. You don't need a sprawling epic for a horror film. I mean, if you know what you're doing and in the right hands, and Patrick Bryce's hands, although I've not seen a lot of his other work, it's really, really well executed, well developed, and pretty damn well realized. So, okay, yeah, I mean, man, not as good as the first one, which is the case for a lot of sequels, but I think they did enough differently with it and teased, I guess, the ending through ambiguity that there could be actually a third film to fully realize this as a trilogy. But and I would be on board with seeing that as well, because while yes, there are diminishing returns, and maybe the first one is a 4-star effort, and when it comes to POV films, it's a 5-star effort, that's for sure. This one may be a little bit less, so let's say 3.75, but still really dynamite. And just, yeah, again, the fact that these little vignettes, these little conversations, the fact that not only is Sarah artistically ambitious, but she's matched by Aaron, who wants to tell his own story as a sort of a narrator and an artist in his own right, and who references Francis Ford Coppola and wants to get the shot just right. I mean, there's scenes where he wants to be shot in this flowing river under this bridge, and he takes an almost Kubrick approach to it, wanting to have take after take after take, and they actually need breaks so that he can adequately articulate himself, and there are issues with sun in his eyes. So it's actually kind of comedic in a way, that the seriousness with which he takes the aesthetic, not only the content approach, but the visual execution as well. And that's kind of neat. There are comedic elements to the first one, and although some of which admittedly were lost on me, but I think upon reviewing I would catch a little some of the gallows humor as well from that one. But this has that as well, and you can sense Sarah getting frustrated as she is becoming increasingly close to the subject, her documentary subject. So, I mean, man, what a cool idea. And in an era of frivolous, pointless remakes like the recent Texas Chainsaw Massacre, just utter debacle, and you know, some of the just really the litany of bad remakes like the Prom Night one, you could go on and on, or the underwhelming sequels that just totally sink all the goodwill created by the original. This is like some of the later Hellraiser movies, and oh boy, there's just too many to mention here. It's nice to see that, and I think the same could be said about the similarly voyeuristic 13 Cameras and its sequel 14 Cameras, which is just a slight artistic letdown in the sequel, but still firing on most cylinders and still doing pretty well as a film in its own right, that's going to leave a lot of people, I think, mostly satisfied. And at the end of the day, that's what you want, right? You don't want to see this precipitous quality drop off. And I think there's a lot of different ways you could go with a Creep trilogy and a third. I think it's unlimited, especially as new ways of interacting develop, and people take to Twitch and TikTok and all this kind of thing. But yeah, dynamite first movie for sure. And what we've learned is the second one, the artistic ambitions are almost realized to the same extent too. So a pretty good one. Damn good effort here. And anyway, continue to enjoy the show, and we shall talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.